how technology has brought work home.
That 24-hourness of our work has become really normal.
How companies and employees are handling technology that keeps us constantly on call. Plus, job hunting with a record and learning the rituals for the dead. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. Recent news reports have focused on the challenges faced by today's workers. There's no way to leave your job at the office anymore. It's a particular problem for women trying to balance family and work obligations. In a tough economy, can you afford to have a no-work-at-home policy when your boss emails at all hours? Minda Zetlin writes a column for Inc. magazine. She co-authored The Geek Gap, Why Business and Technology Professionals Don't Understand Each Other, and Why They Need Each Other to Survive. She's also president of the American Society of Journalists and Authors, so she understands the challenges faced by the growing number of freelance workers. We sat down to talk about BlackBerries, cell phones, and downtime. When you wrote the book, you were talking about the problems that management might have understanding the technology and the needs of the people who are designing the technology. But now we're talking about how the technology is driving the people.
I guess you would say technology is driving the people. I think people say technology is an enabler. And in this case, it may be an enabler in the AA sense of the word, where it's allowing people to, I don't want to say be addicted to technology, because I don't think that people necessarily get addicted to technology in the way people usually say it, but it's enabling people who are workaholics to be constantly connected. At the same time, it is really becoming a norm that people are constantly connected. And that's a thing. I had to interview somebody who was the head of a mobile, marketing company that worked on the Obama campaign. And I sent him, he's in Brooklyn. It's not like he's on the West Coast. I'm on the East Coast. He's on the East Coast. I sent him an email that said, would you be available for an interview? And he wrote back and said, sure, how about 7 p.m. tomorrow? And that was normal. You know, it didn't occur to him for a moment that that might be inconvenient. And the only reason I said no is because I actually had a meeting that I had to be at that evening. Otherwise, I would have said fine. And that's that 24-hourness of our work has become really normal, and for a lot of people. And it's true that for people with family lives, it could be a real issue.
Is there such a thing as a weekend anymore for working people?
That's a very good question. As you know, because I sent you the article, some big companies such as PricewaterhouseCoopers are now saying, you should not read your email over the weekend, and we're going to try and have email-free weekends. And it's a discipline, and I frankly, I'm not sure that I could stop reading my email over the weekend. It would be really hard. And a lot of times I send out email on a Friday or late in the day on a Friday saying, looking to set up interviews for the following week. And usually the PR people answer me that over the weekend. And when I don't hear back from people until Monday, it's kind of like, oh yeah, where are they? It sort of strikes me as unusual. That whole thing is probably not good, I suppose. So, and I'm, as we mentioned, I'm the president of ASJA. The vice president of ASJA, another constantly working freelancer, will actually send me an email or a message to warn me in case she's going to be unavailable over a weekend, which is, I don't quite think it's necessary, but it's become absolutely the norm. It's true.
Are you hearing anything about whether businesses are either expecting more and more to have their people available at all times, or is there some sort of a blowback on this?
The economy being what it is, and people so, unemployment being so high, and people being so happy to have jobs, that have jobs, they're not, I don't think, necessarily blowing back as much as they could. The flip side of this is that more and more people are working as independent contractors. So if you are self-employed, couple of things happen. One is you have to be available for jobs when they come up, and companies that want to manage their resources in a cost-effective fashion will look for people to be available when they need them and only when they need them. So if you aren't watching your email every minute, you might miss something. You might miss an opportunity to make a living. And if you really are running your own business, which so many solopreneurs are, whether they think of it that way or not, then you feel like you need to be available all the time because, again, you could miss something. You could miss an opportunity, and that's what makes you, that's what makes people come to you instead of someone else. The other thing is that people, the other part of this that maybe we haven't talked about or aren't talking about is that people like technology and they like all these new devices and they love having tablets. God knows I do. And they love having iPhones. God knows I love mine. And they like using them for work. They like using them all the time for everything. And one of the things that's come up in a lot of companies is BYOD, the whole bring your own device thing. People don't want to carry around a work cell phone and a personal cell phone. So more and more companies are letting people use their own technology for work. That raises a whole bunch of other questions, but one of the things it does is that, okay, your cell phone that you have in your hand all the time because you like it, you use it to listen to music, you use it to keep in touch with your kids, you use it to go on Facebook. When work stuff comes through, it's right there. So there is that aspect of it too.
Do you think that this, whether you're a full-time employee or a freelancer, you're always available, is it changing businesses' attitude toward remote employees? Because it used to be, oh no, we can't have people who, they might not be at their desk, we might not be able to reach them. Now everyone's treated like a remote employee on their day off.
You know, I think it might be. I see that more and more, and I think it's doing something else too that I kind of like, which is it's breaking down the barrier between your very corporate work life and your not so corporate home life a little bit. I used to worry about, I have cats, and sometimes I'd be on the phone interviewing somebody or talking to a corporate client and there'd be a meow in the background, or I would try to do everything I could to avoid there being a meow in the background. And now I'm talking to corporate executives and they'll say, oh, my dog is here or whatever. They're often working from home. And that's becoming very common. So yes, I think that's true. I think it has changed. It's changed the attitude towards schedules, and it's changed the attitude toward the work-home division. It's probably changed the degree of formality, certainly at least in the tech world, which tends to be informal anyway. It's changed the degree of formality that's needed. So yeah, and some of that may not be terrible.
Could you imagine, though, I can't. How do you make all of this work if you have young children? It is no longer enough to say we've got daycare. When you're home with your children, you're still accessible.
That's true. And not having children myself, I can only conjecture and observe. People I know who work with small children do make it work. Freelance writing is obviously a profession that a lot of people turn to when they do have children. And I interviewed someone who said that he had been on the phone with a journalist who would go through a whole diaper change while interviewing him. That, I guess that is how people balance that. I don't know. Because other than having someone in the home who can take over your child whenever you need it, or having two spouses there, one of whom is always available, it could get tricky.
What do you see ahead? Since you kind of keep a finger on what's happening technology, where do you think this is going?
Well, I think it's going to get more so before it gets less so. And the reason I say that is because those of us in the tech world, and maybe you too, have heard a lot lately the phrase the post-PC era, which we are supposedly just coming into right now, where people are doing everything by mobile device more and more, and actual desktop or laptop computer less and less. And again, people like that. People usually prefer to use a smartphone or a tablet or something of that nature rather than have to sit at a desk in front of a computer. So as we get more and more mobile and more of our work becomes more easily doable in a mobile fashion, I think that's going to become more and more the norm. You saw there are some companies saying, wait a second, people who don't ever disconnect aren't as productive as people who do take downtime sometimes. And so we are asking you not to answer your email over the weekend. So there may be some of that too. It would be really hard to free me from checking my email all the time. It's like an umbilical connection for me, I think. If I can't check my email, I really don't know where I am in the world or in life. But I'm trying.
Minda Zetlin is a columnist for Inc. magazine. She's the co-author of The Geek Gap, Why Business and Technology Professionals Don't Understand Each Other and Why They Need Each Other to Survive. Find out more at mindazetlin.com. Up next, a growing segment of the population has a criminal record. What does that mean when you're looking for a job? Plus, an indoctrination into a religious ritual for the dead. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1214. For 65 million people with an arrest or a conviction, the increased use of background checks in hiring make it that much more difficult to find a job. In April, new policies were issued for employers regarding how they should consider someone's criminal background. KALW's Kyungjin Lee reports.
By the time Cheryl Lozano was 27 years old, she already had several run-ins with the law.
All of it has been under the influence of PCP, possession of PCP. On one occasion, DUI, second time that happened, third time, and then I was sent to prison.
She got clean when she came out and held down several jobs. She was a radiology clerk, receptionist, a bookkeeper.
There weren't doing that many background checks, so it was easier for me to establish a job.
For 14 years, everything was fine, but in 2005, she relapsed and she lost her job. When she got back in the market, she didn't realize how much things had changed since she came out of prison in the late 90s. She always checked yes when asked about criminal convictions.
But I never got called back. And the one job that I did get called back, when they did a background check, they said no because I had DUI on my record.
Today, competition for jobs is as fierce as ever. As of March, there were about 3 unemployed workers for every available job in the U.S. This puts employers in a position to be picky.
It's delivered refrigerated as well.
Sil Kravacheza owns a beverage company in Livermore and is looking to hire 2 drivers. Because of the overwhelming response in the past, he now requires applicants to apply in person with their DMV records. His Craigslist ad also specifies no criminal history.
It seems to me that anybody that has a criminal history has a DMV problem. You know, to me, that's somebody that may have a criminal background. So we eliminate that immediately.
He says he's had some bad experiences with ex-offenders in the past. Kravacheza says he's also had positive experiences with ex-offenders and would still consider someone with a criminal record. But he says he needs a way to filter applicants.
We would be here all day long interviewing people. And actually, you know, 90 people last time applied. So yeah, we do have to filter it down.
But Maurice Anselm says this type of hiring practice might be illegal. He's an attorney with the National Employment Law Project.
They have to show that the practice is job-related, that they've looked at the age of the offense, the seriousness of the offense, and the person's record compared to the job that they're applying to.
That's according to guidelines issued by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission 25 years ago. Anselm says today, conditions have gotten much worse for people with criminal backgrounds. That's because that population is growing and background checks are more common. So the EEOC issued new guidelines. They reinforce the basic principles of its past policy, but now the guidelines provide updates on what's legal and illegal in hiring.
The employers need to take some time to look at the individual. If you have a system online that says so-and-so with a record won't qualify and they're immediately rejected on the online application, then by definition, they haven't really taken a serious look at the individual.
That's Raymond Chen's problem. Chen was a sophomore at San Jose State studying computer science when he was arrested and sentenced to 30 months in federal prison. Chen's been out of prison since November and has been looking for work.
I believe I already applied for this one.
Chen diligently checks Craigslist and submits one or two job applications every day, mostly for warehouse or data entry positions.
I got like a couple of calls back, but most of the time, you know, because my resume, it shows that, you know, I only worked once, which was in 2008, I believe, when I was working at UPS. And then they would ask me, you know, what I've been doing since 2008 till now. And I can't really lie about it. So I just tell them the truth and then they never call you back right afterwards.
Today, 65 million people in the U.S., that's one in four adults, have an arrest or conviction that will show up in background checks. What's worse, they are often riddled with incomplete information. In fact, Emsalem says back in 2006, a Department of Justice report found that half of the FBI's background checks are inaccurate. That means an arrest that never leads to a conviction might still pop up in one of these checks. Emsalem says this unfairly disadvantages millions of workers in finding employment, especially people of color.
African Americans are arrested at three times the rate compared to their representation in the general population. Whites are arrested at half their rate compared to their representation in the general population. So that's a significant disproportionate impact, and that's true around the state.
To give you a sense of the scope of this imbalance, in some major U.S. cities like Chicago, almost 80% of working-age African-American men have criminal records. In Oakland, there's an office supply company looking to improve the situation. It's called Give Something Back. It proactively hires people who've had trouble finding work, including ex-offenders.
If you walk around the office, you'll find a tremendous diversity in this office, and that's a residue of a design. That doesn't happen by accident. We reach out to try to make sure our workforce is representative of the community.
President Mike Hannigan says while his company provides additional training for these employees, their quality of work is no different than those without records. And he says the myth that ex-offenders are more prone to stealing or causing trouble is just that, a myth.
I mean, the fact of the matter is people misunderstand what incarcerated populations are like. I mean, they're as diverse as regular populations. Some of them are hard cases. Some of them are people who had bad experiences and did bad things once in a while. But some of them can transition into very productive, careers.
Hannigan says there are also certain benefits for employers who hire people with criminal records, such as tax credits.
And also there's lots of benefit once they do integrate because they tend to be very loyal, very productive, and appreciate the opportunity of work.
Oh, I was a go-getter, I believe, even from an early age. I wanted to be a DEA agent. I know that sounds crazy, but it's the truth.
Cheryl Lozano didn't get that DEA job, but she did find a position in sales. She's grateful her employer didn't use a background check when evaluating her. Some companies are coming around reluctantly. Earlier this year, the EEOC successfully sued Pepsi because its hiring policy excluded anyone with an arrest record, which disproportionately affected African-American applicants. The beverage company has since changed its hiring practices. Advocates hope these high-profile cases will encourage smaller employers to change their practices voluntarily. As for job seekers with criminal records, the two words of advice heard over and over again are, don't lie, no matter how tempting. For Cross Currents, I'm Kyungjin Lee.
Finally, women's work has always included the rituals surrounding both birth and death. Writer Deborah Sabin recounts what happened when she convinced her friend to join her in learning to help with the Jewish rituals for the dead.
The matriarch is a kind woman, a very observant Jew with a great sense of humor. Thank God, because she needed all three qualities to initiate us into the ranks of the Chevra Kedisha. We entered through the back of the funeral home. Balanced forlornly on a wheeled table was a plain pine coffin. An unfinished pine box, really. Wait. The coffin was empty. Who were we sitting with? Through a narrow doorway, we could see the body of the lady draped in a white cloth. My friend and I cast one of those wide-eyed, what the hell were we thinking? glances at each other. The older ladies handed us plastic aprons and latex gloves. Before we had time to protest, they were leading us in prayer. The prayer was on poster board, swathed in plastic. We prayed that God would help us perform the deed with the right intentions. What intentions? We had planned to sit quietly through the night, watching over the deceased, already in her coffin. We had not planned on this. We were led into the small room. There was a metal table, a drain beneath it centered in the ceramic tile floor, and a large sink with faucets and hoses. And there was equipment. I looked away. The ritual first involves cleaning the body, trimming nails, and then rinsing the body with a continuous flow of water. And other times, that meant two women pouring from pitchers that were continually refilled by other women. Now, a hose kept up a continuous flow while we poured water over and over the body. The matriarch was gentle and murmured to the deceased woman, apologizing for an awkward moment. She reminisced about card games the lady had hosted at the temple, sharing quiet stories about how beautifully this woman always dressed, what gorgeous hair she had, how everyone had always wanted to sit by her because she was the most fun. We then dressed her in the burial garb. Made of pure white cotton or linen, her final garments were not the fashionable silks and satins she had worn to weddings and bar mitzvahs. Ritual requires that every woman returns to her maker in white trousers with the hems sewn shut, a white tunic, and a white over tunic with the sleeves tied shut, like booties and mittens. The pieces have no buttons or zippers. They are closed with drawstrings, twisted to form the three branches of the Hebrew letter Shin, the first letter of a name for God, El Shaddai. After that came the bonnet and the apron. I balked at the apron and muttered, "What? We have to wait on them in heaven too?" I immediately covered my mouth at my lack of respect at such a solemn time. The words had just slipped out. Then I saw the smile in the matriarch's eyes as she replied, "No, it's for modesty, like the bonnet." Our silent lady had been so cold when we started, but now she was warm and dry. All that was left was to move her to the coffin. We wheeled the plain pine box in from the garage and positioned it next to the table. The room was narrow, and the gurney the coffin rode on was hard to maneuver. The matriarch was adjusting the table when she hit the wrong lever and the table tilted. My friend caught the lady in her arms as we all rushed the table. There was silence, and then the matriarch murmured to the lady her apologies at our clumsiness. We gently eased her into the coffin and wrapped her in the white linen shroud, covering her face at last. Outside it was raining, the sky cloudy and starless on this late October evening. I would like to be able to say that we felt the grace of God surround us as we solemnly acknowledged the mysteries of the universe. But no. We collapsed in helpless giggles, holding on to each other as waves of laughter swept through us. It was the near hysterical laughter of people who had come close to death. It was the giggle of female friends who have shared an experience that no one, not even themselves, would ever believe. It was the humor that humans rely upon to remind themselves that they are still alive. It was a long time before we could speak to each other of our experience without giggling, without reiterating our promise that there was no way we were going to be buried in aprons, without gasping at our almost unforgivable breach of etiquette in nearly dropping the deceased. It was a long time, and a few more taharas, before we could speak about the profoundness of our shared experience, before we came to understand why participating in Chevra Kadisha is the greatest mitzvah, good deed, a Jew can perform. It is a gift that the recipient cannot acknowledge, a gift for which she can never offer her gratitude. The only thanks can come from God.
Deborah Sabin is a writer who lives in New York's Capital District. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.